and welcome to Counting Casualties. I'm your host, Megan Harker. Earlier this month, I took a much-needed vacation and headed down to Savannah, Georgia for a weekend. Savannah is about a five-hour drive from where I currently live, so it wasn't a terrible journey. I arrived about 2 in the morning, put the hotel AC on morgue-level coldness, and tucked in for the night. The last time I was in Savannah, I was in the fifth grade. All I remember is getting a bag of saltwater taffy. At least I think that's a memory of Savannah. Who knows at this point? I remember that it was hot. I brought my giant black floppy hat and a gallon of SPF Undead along this time in hopes that I'd be spared from the traitorous sunlight. The historic district of Savannah is surprisingly small. All in all, it's about 2.5 miles, which is about as wide as the city of Manhattan in New York. Savannah, as you may know, was one of the 13 original colonies and is Georgia's oldest city. Her age and history have given her more of the stranger nicknames. The city built on her dead. It's less promise and more fact that no matter where you step in Savannah, you're crossing over someone's grave. Whether you believe in ghosts or not, the air is definitely different there. And it's not just the humidity. The first place I went to visit was the beautiful Bonaventure Cemetery. Yes, I went on vacation and I visited a cemetery. Don't judge me. Bonaventure is massive. It was originally the home of John Mulrain in 1753. In 1779, the plantation was converted into a hospital for French troops while soldiers attempted to take Savannah back from British control. It was sold in 1782 as government-confiscated land to John Habersham. The youngest grandson of the Mulrain family eventually bought the land back in 1785. His wife, Harriet, would be the first official resident in what would become Bonaventure Cemetery. The last of the Mulrain descendants eventually sold the land at auction to Peter Wiltberger, who added 70 acres while maintaining the Mulrain burial grounds. In 1868, the lands were incorporated into the Evergreen Cemetery Company. To drum up business, the price of lots was lowered from 12.5 cents per foot to 6.5 cents. What a deal! Half-price lots selling like death is going out of style! Evergreen officially became Bonaventure Cemetery in 1907. In 1909, Savannah's Jewish congregation purchased the land at the southern end of the grounds. In 1917, a preparation chapel was built, along with a second gate, in order to maintain Jewish customs. I'm not Jewish, but I started my walking tour of the cemetery there. I cannot describe to you how gorgeous this place is. All the roads are gravel, so that makes walking a little bit difficult at times, but the graves are so well kept. There's an amazing amount of artwork and even a few graves with portraits set into them. I walked for hours, and there's no way I saw even half the cemetery. The mausoleums were breathtaking, and there was so much symbolic statuary that I wish I had a full day to devote to the place. In Section Q, Plot 466, the ashes of 344 Holocaust victims from Alhem, Hanover, Germany are laid to rest. The American Legion Field holds veterans of the World Wars. The Spanish-American War veterans have a section of their own as well. One of Bonaventure's most visited gravesites belongs to Gracie Watson, a 6-year-old girl shown in her Easter finery carved by John Walls, who is also buried at Bonaventure. Perhaps the most famous statue is the Bird Girl, made infamous by the cover of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, a book I have never read. I think in high school, one of our marching band shows was loosely based on the concept, and I mean loosely. It's also a film, which I have never seen. Bird Girl has since been relocated to one of Savannah's art museums for preservation. You can also buy lots of very tiny, very creepy Bird Girl replicas. The day was certainly very hot, and unfortunately I had to abandon my precious cemetery. One of the coolest things, though, is a computer at the main office building. All of the gravesides have been compiled digitally, so you can look up specific names and get the exact plot number and location without spending hours wandering around. I don't know why you wouldn't want to spend hours wandering around, but that's just me. Oh, and word of warning, apparently it's illegal to speak of ghosts while in the cemetery at night. It's totally fine during the day, since there's a 2 p.m. tour, but after dark, all bets are off. It's punishable by law. I'm not sure what sort of punishment it is, but I'd assume there's a fine, and you know, let's just not find out, okay? The whole of Saturday was devoted to River Street. It was, again, obscenely hot, and I spent many unfortunate hours in the sunlight. I don't think it can be called sunlight when the temperature is 90 and the humidity is 50%, and it feels like over 100. I ducked into every store just to bask in the glory of modern air conditioning. Do you know what I saw a lot of? Scorpion lollies? Why would you want that? I bought saltwater taffy instead. Scorpion free, to my knowledge. Now, if you haven't guessed, I'm not much in the way of the touristy type. I don't dig on keychains and t-shirt souvenirs. Instead, I bought medicine bottles. I have an antique glass collection, which surprises no one, and when I saw one of the shops had displays of bottles, I was like a moth to flame. There were so many gorgeous pieces, and somehow I narrowed my selection to two. All of the bottles were recovered from beneath Savannah, and some of them weren't as old as the shop owners would like to think. I mean, you can still get glass Sprite bottles today, so that wasn't really an impressive find. The first one I bought is a beautiful purple medicine bottle circa 1890. The manganese dioxide used to clarify the glass turns purple when exposed to UV sunlight. I'm not sure what it was used to hold, but it's beautiful. The second bottle is also late 1800s. It was produced by the Maltine Company in New York, which is stamped into the glass on the front of the bottle. It's also very, very heavy. The Maltine Company manufactured a cure-all, which was basically wine laced with cocaine. As you might suspect, cure-alls cure nothing. But you'd probably be feeling pretty good after a shot of that stuff. I think it's great that all the bottles came with a little tag detailing some of their histories. If you're wondering what else I have in my collection, I have an empty bottle of potassium chloride from the Merck Company. This one, I believe, is 1940s based on the label. The Merck Company is actually still around. For the record, potassium chloride is the substance used in lethal injections. I also have a bottle of powdered extract of aconite root from Sharp and Dome of Baltimore. This one has something in it, but the bottle's been sealed, which is good because aconite is extremely toxic. These two were given to me as a birthday gift by my friend Jen, because friendship is deadly. The shop also had a couple of Frozen Charlotte dolls, but sadly they were out of my budget. Frozen Charlottes were very popular from 1850 to 1920. They would be given as gifts or baked into Christmas puddings, and it was a creepy tradition and cautionary tale based on a report in 1840 of a girl freezing to death on her way to a New York ball. There's a poem in everything. There was even a male counterpart called a Frozen Charlie. Then we ate lunch at Moon River Brewery. Guess what? It's haunted too. I went into the basement, which looks like a basement, but it was super cold, and I don't know if that was ghosts or the fact that there's a brewery downstairs, so it's really cold, but it was really, really nice. Unfortunately, I didn't get to go on any of the house tours or see the museums, because I was only there for 2 days, which means I'm just going to have to go back for another weekend of fun and overtly creepy activities. It's a little difficult not to have a strange vacation when you're walking over corpses the whole time. Now, I can practically hear those of you who follow me on Twitter screaming, "But Megan, what about the ghost tour?" Other than visiting Bonaventure, the one thing I really wanted to do was take a ghost tour. I've been on two of our local ones, one in Roswell and one in Decatur, and I love walking around looking at historic architecture and hearing stories about these places. I have a soft spot especially for rundown buildings. I took the Sixth Sense tour, which lasted about an hour and covered most of the main squares in the historic district. We started on Jones Street, which is the most affluent part of the city. What amazed me were the number of lampposts still outfitted for gaslight. If you haven't figured it out, I have an affinity for the 1800s, and despite the millions of modern conveniences, for a moment it was like having a slice of that era back. It wasn't just the street lamps, either. Houses had sconces and lanterns, and it was extremely surprising and very cool. Laura, our tour guide, led us to several different houses, all the while reminding us that everywhere we went, the dead rested beneath our feet. How cheery. I'm just going to hit on a few highlights of the tour, but if you're headed to Savannah, I definitely recommend checking out Sixth Sense or one of the other dozens of walking tours offered. There's even a tour given in a hearse if you're not so keen on walking. I guess I should backtrack for a moment here. The first question Laura asked us was whether or not we believed in ghosts. Personally, I have never seen a ghost. I don't think I'd want to, but I do believe that energy can remain and manifest and loop. I've felt things and I've heard things, and at times I'm sort of at odds with the science side of my brain telling me these experiences are impossible. However, the law of conservation of energy states that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, and what are ghosts or spirits but concentrations of energy? We can save ghost chat for another episode, but it's certainly something to consider. The other end is that Savannah really is a city built on the dead, but as mortician Caitlin Doty said in her Deathstination video about Savannah, all you really need to have a haunting is an old house, a tragic story, and some unfortunate events. I'll let you decide how much to believe. The first house on the tour was one of my favorites, and I'm sure it'll be real obvious as to why. The story begins with a girl trying on her wedding dress and the old maiden root worker warning she'd never live to wear it. The girl died before she made it to her wedding day. In fact, she fell ill that very night. In 1830, the building belonged to Dr. Corson. The basement of the house was devoted to his lab and his work. Dr. Corson was a bit of a modern Frankenstein and had an obsession with attempting to photograph the soul using x-rays. Back then, x-rays were extremely dangerous, and I guess they still are, and over time, exposure to the waves rotted his hands. When he died, his family hid his hands so no one would see the withered stumps. Years later, a musician would take up residence. The basement became his recording studio. Late at night, he'd hear harp music from below. Eventually, he went to investigate and found a man sitting at the harp. His hands were missing. The musician was extremely fond of his ghost and actually used the hauntings to get tenants to stay. One of his tenants, who lived in the carriage house out back, was a priest. And one night, the priest took it upon himself to exorcise said ghost. And the musician returned pissed. I mean, it'd be kind of cool to have a musically inclined ghost friend, I guess. The house is currently for sale for a cool $2.5 million, and the original harp is still in the basement. The strangest house is Mercer House, or as Laura liked to call it, the Murder House. The story is a real-life version of the pilot season of American Horror Story. Basically, anyone who's ever owned this house has become a murderer. If, unlike me, you read Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, you'll recognize Mercer House and the tragic tale of Jim Williams and Danny Hansford. But they weren't the first. Oh no. The first owner, Mr. Mercer, whose first name I have forgotten, never lived long enough to complete his house. He was called into battle, and I'm a little iffy on the details of the story, but he was given three men to his custody. I don't remember if they were turncoats or if they were captives or what. He executed them one by one in cold blood. Mercer ran out of money, couldn't finish his house, and eventually died by gunshot to the head. It was then purchased by an elderly couple. One night, the 70-year-old man rolled over in his bed and smothered his wife. He was found below the balcony, his body horrifically twisted. It was deemed a murder-suicide, but the angle of his body was wrong for a man leaping from the window. There was also no motive for the murder. The house sat abandoned, and one day two boys decided to go in and shoot pigeons off the roof. The one boy looked over to see his friend flailing at the edge. He tried to move and couldn't, and his friend fell, except according to him, he didn't fall so much as appeared to be pushed. He hit the fence below so hard it snapped the metal point from the fence post. However, if you go around to the side of the house and look at the roof, it overhangs the fence. It would have been impossible for the boy to fall, hit the fence, and land inside it because the space is so narrow. The papers deemed it a freak accident. And then there's Jim Williams. He renovated and restored the home and moved in. He was affluent and well-liked and apparently threw great Gatsby-esque parties, or so I'm told. And in true Gatsby-esque fashion, one night he murdered Danny Hansford, a man he'd hired to work around the house, though many speculated they were lovers. Williams claimed that Hansford assaulted him. Hansford's friends said William killed him in cold blood. He stood trial for years because there was no way he would have an impartial jury in Savannah. Williams was acquitted, eventually. Some say he hired a root worker and she'd go to Danny's grave and appeal to the spirit. Perhaps it worked, since William walked away, but he never thanked or paid the woman. That night, he died of a heart attack in the library where he'd shot Danny. Moral of the story? Always thank and pay your root worker or bad shit happens. Also, don't go into Mercer House. Okay, go into Mercer House, but stay out of the South Side, because the South Side is cursed. It's currently owned by William's sister. The lower levels are now a museum, and she keeps the upstairs as her residence. So you can, in fact, wander into the murder house, if you so choose. Exercise caution. Savannah's prominent law school used to be a hospital. You know how crazy I get with medical things, so I'll try and keep it brief. Recently restored, students claim to see nurses in the windows and on the grounds. Thousands of yellow fever victims died there, and in true Victorian fashion, the resurrection men would claim the corpses. They'd either be buried in mass graves or sold to physicians. Dissections were illegal, but chances are no one would be missing the dead. They'd perform their experiments and dump the bodies in the ground. Oh, another issue? Savannah is hot. And Savannah is humid, and there is no such thing as air conditioning. So what else do you do but you make a death tunnel to store the corpses until burial? You can still see the access points in the parking lot outside the building. Oh, and the city's only 5-star hotel? Yeah, that's set atop the mass grave of yellow fever victims. Sweet dreams. The last house I want to talk about is the one that disturbed me the most. I've been on several ghost tours. Hell, I grew up in a household where Stephen King was a holy name. Only one other time have I been physically affected by a house, but I'll get to that in a minute. Here, I want to place a word of caution because the story is extremely disturbing. Perhaps I should mitigate it by saying that historically, these stories don't check out. The records don't match or don't exist, but what I can tell you is how I felt, and it wasn't good. Laura called this house the House of Rage. It's 432 Abercorn. The historical plaque bearing the family's name has been removed, so it's known only by its street number. I'd heard tell of this house from a friend who has gone to Savannah multiple times, but it was another thing to see it for myself. The minute that Lori pointed at the giant bay window, I knew that this was the house. The first story involves a man and his daughter. She loved to play with the other children, but her father thought them beneath her. He forbid her from associating with them. Well, as children do, she disobeyed. As punishment, her father made her sit in a chair in the bay window and watch as the other children played. Remember, it's Savannah. It's hot. all the time. The girl died from dehydration and heat exposure. Basically, she roasted alive. Records for the house show that there was a man and his daughter, two daughters, actually, and both lived well into old age. The next event occurred when three teenage girls and a little sister were left alone while their parents went out for the evening. They returned to find a bloodbath, with the three oldest girls laid head to feet in a triangle, disemboweled like a Jack the Ripper case. The child was found huddled in an upstairs closet. There is no record for this ritual murder. The third story is that Anton Levy rented the house for 8-month periods, blocking out the windows and doing whatever ritualistic things he did. They say that the house was the epicenter for satanic activity. Then the house was a fraternity, and one night during a raging party, one of the boys had had enough, and he went upstairs to bed and vanished. No one lives in this house now. It's fallen into disrepair. The ceiling is collapsing. People have asked to buy the house, and the answer is always no. They've set up automatic lights to dispel people from breaking in. A reporter once tracked down the owner who lives up north. When asked why she wouldn't sell, because let's face it, the property is worth millions, the woman said she didn't want anyone else to experience the horror she faced as a child. This should lead you to believe that the current owner is the girl who survived the homicide. Laura said that we could approach the house. I did, and was immediately ill. The air was so thick it was difficult to breathe. You could feel the weight of the place. My eyes started to water, my mouth went dry. Only one other building has ever made me have a physical reaction, and that's Creepy House in Roswell. Creepy House is no longer standing, but the first time I approached it, I thought I was going to throw up. Whether any of those stories are true or not, I can't deny the horribly oppressive feeling I got. Even writing this episode, I started creeping myself out. It's not a nice place. Don't go there. There is nothing good in that house, whether it's haunted or bedeviled or just extremely negative. It turns out my friend's roommate also became physically ill when she approached the house, and she's a bit of a skeptic. I felt icky. There's something there, and I have absolutely no desire to find out what it is. If you're morbidly curious, I'll be posting a few of the photographs I took from Bonaventure and the tour on my blog along with this episode. If you get a chance to visit Savannah, I do highly recommend it. If you're a beach bunny, Tybee Island is a 20-minute drive away. The seafood everywhere is delicious, and I promise you'll walk away with a few stories of your own. Oh, and try the Pirate's House. Those biscuits are some sort of magic, and if I could have taken a gallon of their orange marmalade home, I totally would have. Oh, and it's haunted too. Remember, Savannah is built on her dead. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of Counting Casualties. If you'd like to keep up with the show or suggest a topic for a future episode, send us a tweet at Casualty Podcast. You can also follow my personal account at Exquisitely Odd. Past and future episodes can be found at exquisitelyodd.com. The intro and outro is Ghost Story by Kevin MacLeod, used under the Creative Commons license. I'll catch you next month with a brand new episode, and as always, stay strange.
On Cantert Highway, but I don't seem to have any rating information for it. Is that the one you're looking for? Sorry, mistress, I didn't get it.
Apparently Siri wants to be out on the conversation. Did you recommend me a good birthday gift from my friend Jen Deadly? It sent me to a florist. I don't think so. Sorry, Siri. Nice try, though.